Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Aval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today is Dr. Erdi Öztürk. He is the author of a new book called Religion, Identity, and Power, Turkey and the Balkans in the 21st Century, which is being produced by the Edinburgh University Press. He's also an associate professor at London Metropolitan University and Coventry University. Dr. Öztürk, pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I would like to talk to you about your new book. And the first question I'd really like to ask of you is if you can provide just our listeners a walkthrough on what exactly your book is focusing on. The focus is clear that it's about Turkey's influence in the Balkans, in three countries that were all former territories of the Ottoman Empire. But can you walk us through some of the main elements of your research that you put into the book?
Yes, indeed. Tamam. Thank you so much, first of all, having me and to describe me my brand new book. Well, actually, I'm always saying the same stuff when I'm trying to describe my book, but it is a true story because this book is a product of a personal experience, or I would easily say that it's a kind of a twist of fate. I mean, after many different critical junctions in my life, I started to live in Ljubljana, which is the capital of Slovenia. Even though Ljubljana is not a classical Balkan capital, you can see and you can smell every single taste of the Balkans, thanks to the migrants from Bosnia, Serbia, North Macedonia, Bulgaria, Kosovo, and Albania. And I realized that all of these Balkan components, Balkan citizens, have been following Turkish news, politics, and culture very closely. And they have different and variable feelings about Turkey. But always they have been commonly underlined one single point, which is Turkey is back. But the ways of being back was very diverse for them. And then when we look at the academic, semi-academic, and the journalistic actual literature, when we saw that, we have been seeing lots of stories, lots of news, lots of articles, research regarding the Turkey's increasing influence in the Balkan Peninsula. But it wasn't that clear how these influence can be reacted in the region and what is the reactions of the local elites in that region. Therefore, I would easily say that my book is aimed to scrutinize the Turkey's influence in the region. But this is only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, I mean, this book is also regarding what kind of elements in international relations and the foreign policy can be the main determinant of the countries when they create different kind of relations. Therefore, on the one hand, this book is a kind of an area studies, which is true, which is obviously only focusing on Turkey, North Macedonia, Bulgaria, and Albania. But at the same time, I would easily say that this is not only area studies, political science, and international studies book, because it's mostly based on more than 3 years fieldwork and more than 130 semi-structured elite interview. Therefore, this book has an interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary dimensions, which has been standing on an intersectionality of history, sociology, and anthropology. This is, as I said, this is mostly because of the long, long, long fieldwork. But at the same time, there is also a theoretical background, because as you can see from the title of the book, Religion, Identity, and Power, I argue that as an instinct part of the country's identity, religion has the capacity to shape the politics, global politics and foreign politics as well, and the power relations, as well as the state identities. And I think what I argued that religion and the religion-oriented power struggles, to the extent that it forms part of a state identity, therefore, it can shape both first domestic politics and then foreign policy, even if the actors can be sometimes secular or not. So I argued that in that book, every single country has have multi-faced and multi-layered identities. And within these identities, religion and the power relations are very big determinants. And we can easily understand the importance of religion, power, and identity via testing Turkey's multi-layered, sometimes very gloomy, and I used as an ambivalence role in the region, in the Balkans. So this is basically the summary of my book. Oh, it is so difficult to summarize the book and the more than 4 years work in a couple of minutes, but I think this is all I can say about the summary of the book.
It was an absolutely impressive amount of field work that I was able to see that you put into it. 130, almost 130 interviews across that period of time in the region is absolutely something to point out. And in that region, I'd also just like to focus for a second on the three countries that you chose, North Macedonia, Albania, and Bulgaria. As I mentioned earlier, these were all former Ottoman Empire territories. Mm-hmm. Of course, today they're NATO members as well. And they're, well, aside from Bulgaria, who's already in the European Union, at least the other two countries are aspiring members. One thing I'd like to ask you, though, for these three is, what is the importance of them to Turkey that you chose to focus on these three for your book?
But yes, indeed. Like, first of all, let me tell you that, yes, on the one hand, in the book, the main skeleton, the main backbone of the book is mostly based on the more than 130 elite interviews with prime ministers, with foreign ministers, with the intelligence service members, imams, so on and so forth. But at the same time, I had an opportunity to travel all around the region, Serbia, Sanjak region particularly, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Kosovo, even Montenegro, even every single even in a single villages in Slovenia. I mean, it also has many different anecdotes from, quote-unquote, I know it's not very politically correct, but from ordinary people. I mean, when I came face-to-face with the Kosovo citizen in the western part of France, I talk with them. When, for example, in the northern part of the North Macedonia, I talk many different elderly Muslim Albanian people. So you can find at the same time the ordinary people's feelings about the role of religion, identity, and power regarding the Turkey's activities in the region. What I said about regarding my country case selections, as I said, this book is, I mean, if one will consider that book as a Balkan book, or that book is only looking for the Turkey's influence in the Balkans, I mean, that would be a misleading, because this book's main problematic, main question, main issue that I want to scrutinize is, as I said, the role of religion, identity, and power in foreign policies. Therefore, I choose Albania, Bulgaria, and North Macedonia, because these three countries, these are the only countries that invited Turkey in the end of the 1990s, because Turkey and Turkey's one particular transnational state apparatus, which is called Presidency of Religious Affairs, which is Diyanet. They invited Turkey's Diyanet, apart from the embassies, because of Turkey's sui generis secularization that we called laic state structure and identity. This means that even though Turkey has official representations, embassies in the Balkan countries, only these three countries saw Turkey as totally laic state and accept its presence domestically with the primary religious state apparatus of Turkey, namely Diyanet. This is a huge huge significant indicator for a country, because it's regarding the perceptions. I mean, what I heard from lots of former prime ministers, president, and the foreign ministers, they always underlined that they invited Turkey's Diyanet because of Turkey's laic state identity. They believe that only a laic and the modern Muslim majority country can take care of their Muslims. If, according to them, if they didn't invite Turkey in the first place, most of the fundamentals and the extremist groups could affect their Muslim communities. So this is a huge indicator. And over the previous three decades, I observed what has transformed within these countries' perceptions regarding Turkey and the Turkey's laic state identity. And this also gives me to scrutinize my three key concepts, religion, identity, and power. At the same time, these three countries is quite eligible to give me the broader sense of the Balkans. Indeed, it's impossible to get the, all the senses of the Balkans from one book, even though there have been more than 10 tiny, historically similar, demographically similar countries in the Balkans. They have all, they have different paths, different different demographic structures, different qualifications. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, when you put the Serbia, it might be the Bosnia-Herzegovina will be the missing points. When you put the Bosnia-Herzegovina, the other countries will be the missing points. But these three countries, for example, Albania, which is more than 60-65% of the Albanian population is Muslim, despite of it is very secular, and the tolerated structure of the state, and it is a state, there is a huge inequalities between the Muslims and the non-Muslims in the state structure. As you said, Bulgaria is the member of the EU, and more than 50% of the 15% of the populations are Muslim. And these Muslims are, some of them are coming from the Turkic backgrounds, and they're also Turkish speakers. But we know that their situation within the state structure, within the state society, is not very solid. Macedonia, North Macedonia, there's huge disputes in the international area with Greece due to the name problem, and also has a very large number of Muslim minority, almost 30-35% of the population. But at the same time, in terms of economy, in terms of state structure, it's a relatively weak, weak state. So all of these are giving some different indicators, different dynamics, and different photos that will give some similarities within the Balkan region.
It does bring to mind, actually, a previous podcast we had with Baskin Oran. He also spoke about how the role of religion in how Turkey treats its own domestic minorities and how that factors into the domestic Turkish context. But he did say that he did take it to a wider regional. He took a wider regional look. And he said something in his view was that religion was sort of like the binding element in terms of the national identity for many countries in the region, whether it was Turkey or other countries in the Balkans. So it, and if I can just add from my own background, I studied Russian area studies, and we touched on the soft power influence of, say, the Russian Orthodox Church in some of the Balkan countries. It does seem to validate the idea that religion is sort of, again, like a glue that works in these very, in this very amorphous, from an identity standpoint, region. Why is that the reason why religion is takes on this sort of central role in your research for the topic you're investigating related to Turkey's soft power?
I mean, it has like a couple of reasons. The first thing is that, I mean, even though we've been like since 1924, I mean, and then officially in 1937, Turkey defined itself as a laic country. I mean, it's impossible to understand the Turkey's domestic political conflicts without considering the religion and the religious groups inside in this, all of these power struggles. This is the power side and the domestic politics side of my book. I try to read all of the Turkish domestic politics starting from the late Ottoman Empire period via putting religion, Sunni Islam mostly, to the one of the focal points of the state agenda. This is the one point. The second point is that even though there's been a mushrooming literature about the Turkey's soft power and the religious-oriented soft power with, under the AKP regime, under the control of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, what we saw that starting from the 1930s and then particularly after 1970s and 1990s, Turkey has been using it as secular, it is laic state identity, and also it is a moderate understanding of Islam within the foreign policy. At the same time, I tried to read all the foreign policy activities of Turkey, not only for the Balkans, but also in a general, in a broader sense, within this book. So I put the religion into the core of these situations. But what I saw that, like, I mean, there have been a huge discussion regarding what does it mean religious soft power, and what is the difference between being a soft power, being a sharp power, and being a hard power. And if you talk about religion, and if we talk about the current circumstances of Turkey's instrumentalization and the using of religion as a soft power tool, I'm using its quote unquote, I mean, we have to scrutinize and define what is Turkey's real situation is right now. In the book, what I argued that Turkey, like many other countries all around the world, is gradually withdrawing from an international cooperation, and it is restoring a new distinction between Western understanding of civilization by synthesizing a very subjective nationalism with a very nostalgic vision of history, memory, and Sunni Islam. And this transformation has been happening under the control of Erdogan, but at the same time, he's been changing political partners. I said unofficial coalition partners. They were the Gulenbaums, and right now they are Islamist, nationalist, Eurasianist. And this creating the kind of a transformation within the state identity. Even though in the literature, some underline that Turkey has been getting stronger and independent and being a big game changer while increasingly addressing the global audiences. While scrutinizing the Balkan cases, I'm rejecting this idea actually. Since for my book, according to my book, the transformations of state identity, Turkey's state identity under Erdogan and his unofficial coalition partners term is undoubtedly creating a jargoning effect. And within this transformation, Sunni Islam has been playing a dominant role. Sunni Islam is a very disputable concept. I'm not a theologist, but I'm saying that the instrumentalization of current Turkish government's Islam is quite problematic. And it is obviously that in the Turkish case, the reconciliation and the instrumentalization of Islam, and with a combination of nationalism and the combination of the right-wing populism, and not reactive, not proactive, but very aggressive foreign policy strategies have created various different situations. And within these circumstances, it is hard to define Turkey's current activities and using the overdose of religion as a pure soft power. Therefore, if it's definitely not a sharp power, it's definitely not a sharp power, not an hard power, but if one would like to insist to define it as a kind of a soft power and the kind of a religious soft power, I define it as an ambivalence of religious soft power. If you combine religion within the foreign policy with other elements, such as authoritarianism or aggressive type of foreign policy, or using overdose of your financial capitals to impose your ideas within the other society or other states, this would be defined as a kind of an ambivalency of the religious soft power that I inherited the concept from the Scott Appleby of Notre Dame University in the U.S.
Sometimes this makes me think actually about how when we sometimes hear about this conversation about Turkey's instrumentalization of its, overseas activity for the Diyanet or religious soft power, if you will, it does take on a bit of a securitized tone depending on the case. Of course, you know, we know very well how countries in the Middle East, whether it's in the Gulf, have reacted to Turkey's promotion of what they see as a subversive form of political Islam that undermines their own countries. And then, of course, we saw this debate come up as well in France last year on the role of foreign-trained or foreign-educated imams in France, and of course the role of Islam in that separate society. But you spoke to quite a number of government officials in the Balkans, the three countries that you visited, and beyond that, including some officials in the foreign policy apparatus or the intelligence apparatus. Are there similar fears in these countries, or in this region rather, that some of this Turkish soft power propagation is subversive or dangerous from a domestic stability standpoint that we see in other parts of, say, Europe or the Middle East?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, actually, this, as I said, I mean, this is an academic book. I mean, this is not an actual book. And therefore, I combined a couple of different international relations theories within the theoretical background. And one is that the hierarchies between states. And when we saw, I mean, you tell it's a dangerous or not, I mean, defining it as a dangerous would be quite an ambitious term. But what I would say that states can perceive the Turkey's current activities, religion-oriented activities, and beyond, perceived very differently according to their positionality, according to their power structures against Turkey or, I mean, within their club. But what I saw that, I mean, this rivalry regarding who's going to be the leader of the global ummah or using the religion and the religious tools becoming a very visible or a vocal actor in other host countries is something quite common for the Balkan region as well. I mean, indeed, the same actor has been active, Turkey, in France, in Netherlands, in Sweden, and in the Balkans as well. But this service to the global ummah is kind of a problematic issue when we look at the Balkan case. What I found that, indeed, Turkey is not only active with Diyanet in the region, but despite all other activities, when we look at the investments of Turkey and how these investments are mainly perceived by the local elites of the Balkans. When I saw that, the Justice and Development Party has realized that Turkey's Western-oriented laic foreign policy has not been serving the new interests, desires of Turkey, and therefore it aims to establish a deeper relations with the Balkan countries or becoming a very bold, very impactful within the Balkan countries. But in here, I mean, the countries or the particularly with the Muslims of these countries is the big question mark or the elephant in the room. I mean, indeed, Turkey has, in fact, has been preferring to serve the Ummah instead of expanding its relations with all the components of the Balkans, in spite of its very fragile economic conditions. Therefore, this mostly single-sided and religion-oriented investment approach is one of the significant indicators of how its preferences make Turkey an ambivalent religious soft power. Because on the one hand, on the one side of the coin, it may be very happy for Sunni Muslim religious communities components, but at the same time, for example, for Bektash, it's a huge problem, or some non-Muslim policymakers, it's a very, very big issue. And beyond that, there's different issues, instrumentalization of religion and religious tools, such as exportation of domestic conflicts, the conflict between Gulen and the AKP still alive in the region, and then the interfering the domestic political dynamics to the regions is another issue, or threatening the very fragile secular conditions of these countries using the religious tools is another issue in the region.
Excuse me, but one thing I'd also like to ask you is just in your view, because it does convey this idea that this retooling of Turkey's soft power apparatus is meant to be, as you said, more kind of like befitting of this new ambitious great power image that the AKP might have for Turkey. And I've talked about this subject before on the podcast as well with another guest, Dr. Samuel Romani. He's a doctoral researcher over at Oxford, and he was talking about how that has carried through actually in Africa, the use of soft power to develop some influence and build and make some friends along the way, of course. But one question I'd like to ask you, in your view, just through all of this, whether it's in the Balkans or just about Turkey's use of religion in general as a soft power tool, what are its limits to you? What are the kind of limitations that it has run into that you've seen in your research, in your view?
Well, many different limitations. I mean, I think Balkans and some of the African countries, thanks to the shared Ottoman past, is quite easy to implicate. But at the same time, language, understanding of Islam, and the state capacities and instrumentalization of both state apparatuses and also non-state apparatuses is quite limited for Turkey. Yes, right now what we know that Turkey, by boosting its like the religious soft power and using the leadership figure and converting the state as a one-man state, been boosting its religious soft quote-unquote, religious soft power all around the world. But it's a big question how they would be effective all around the world, because there are many different understandings of Islam, and I'm not sure the Turkish state identity, state capacity, and the state institutions are enough ready to give the answers of all of these different demands. So this is the one point. The second point is that, I mean, Turkey is not alone in this field. I mean, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Morocco, even Bosnia-Herzegovina is a part of this big revival all around the world. And this is a kind of a big cake, and every single country has its own limits. They can only eat their proportions, their slices. So Turkey has, yes, there are some advantages regarding Turkey because the member of the NATO, still among the G20, and Erdogan, despite of all of these authoritarian drifts, so on and so forth, it is still finding some responders, companies with world leaders. But this is the one side of the coin. But at the same side, yes, Diyanet is very influential, more than 55 countries all around the world. But how they can serve all of these Muslims without knowing the local languages? So these imams, whether they're well-trained or not, how they can compete with Salafis, with Wahhabis in the region? For example, in the Balkans, there's a huge competition between Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So Turkey can have its own audiences, and Saudi Arabia have its own audiences. So there will be no winner within this game, and there will be no super strong influential soft power, because all of these countries have been some problematic backbones, such as their regime types, such as their economies, such as the images of their leaders, their public figures, so on and so forth. So this will be a very difficult situation for countries to be a very pure, strong soft power.
Dr. Öztürk, it was a great pleasure to really have you walk through your whole book. And it's something, actually, I'm personally looking forward to getting my own hands on it and adding it to my reading list as well. So I'll let you know when that also happens. But in the meantime, we've reached the end of the program. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time to join me on this Saturday.
Thanks again.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.